The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 4 podcast.
We welcome you back. We've made it to the final hour. It's been a busy show. Stuart Mandel joining us in a few minutes. We'll get his take on the playoff and dynasties. Looking forward to talking to him, as always. More of your phone calls here at 855-242-7285. And where are we here? How about Matt in Florida? Hey, Matt, thank you. Good afternoon. Matt, you there?
Paul?
Yeah, go right ahead.
I just want to say thank you for everything you've done over the past, crazy year and plus we've had. To cast the callers that you have every day.
Thank you.
To the cast that you've got behind the scenes. You guys do a fantastic job. Thank you for what you've done for
Thank you. These 15 months, I think we've all experienced things. I was talking to someone yesterday just about this odyssey, and I feel like it's over. Maybe I'm being too optimistic, everyone's seeing the turn. And it has been so special to have everybody here with us.
I got a school for you to add to the SEC.
Sure.
What if we got Virginia Tech, and then that opens up that recruiting ground?
That's a good one, because I think Virginia Tech, whether you could ever pry them away is, but they do offer a very important state. And region that I think marries the SEC very well. And I know some people have argued about West Virginia, but I think Virginia Tech is a better fit.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much. And thanks for the kind words. Okay. And I really appreciate that. Not to get sappy here, but as we make this turn, I mean, we're a month away from the SEC Media Days, which is the final doggy door we have to go through to get out of COVID. It has been quite a journey, and I appreciate everyone out there for helping to contribute. Thank you very, very much. Let's talk to Catherine, who is in Florida. Hello, Catherine. Go right ahead.
Hi, Paul. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to compliment you because you just seem so much more relaxed now than, of course, this time last year, and your enthusiasm and stuff is just really great. And
thank you.
And now you've got plenty of stuff to talk about.
Well,
summer's not going to be boring.
Yeah, Catherine, in all candor, I don't know when I've been more excited about a football season. I think I speak for everyone. I don't think my take is unique. It's just heard. A year ago, I would like to go back and maybe do a few things differently, but we were living through something that we did not have any primer for. We really didn't know what we were doing.
No, there's no preparation for what we have been through, but I also want to say I love to hear you talk about your mom and and when you talk about your dad. I know that they had to be, I would think, an influence on maybe why you went into journalism and then major with sports being
It's funny. I wrote an article once about my mom, Catherine, that of all the things I've done, it's the thing I'm most proud of. And I had some line in there that said, as a young kid growing up, I mean, I said, I don't think I'll ever become a great novelist because, the great novelists always had problems in their childhood. And I mean, it didn't matter. There was alcoholism. There was abuse. You name it. The greatest writers, and really that goes for a lot of creative people, not all, but most. We were fairly normal people growing up, and you've heard me tell the story as it made the turn toward my teens, it all changed. But my mother, became such an important part of my life because she took on, as many others mothers have done, the role of a father as well. And she's been gone 25 years, but I still think about her and miss her every day.
I bet. I like how I think she's she let you stay home to either listen to?
Oh, yeah. No, she, yeah, my dad, interestingly, I had the antithesis of most homes. I did not have the traditional Southern upbringing, considering both parents were from New York. But my dad was always the one that was letting me get away with stuff. I would go to him and say, okay. Mom won't let me go here. And he would slip me a couple of dollars and I would go. Usually the dad, you go in and say something about your mom and you're lucky if you're still standing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was sort of like in my household too. I would go to my father, but you know, my parents were a big influence too on how I learned to like sports, because when I was like 3 or 4, my uncle played high school ball. So I remember them taking us to see him, and then my brother played football in high school, and my mom, she really got to be an avid fan. And then my dad, I grew up watching the Detroit Tigers with him, and then, you know, watching college football on Saturdays. And then, of course, when I married my husband, he was definitely a fanatic for sports. So, and it's just been fun. And I want to tell you, Paul, this college baseball is just awesome. Last night, I cannot believe those fans in that stadium.
Oh, it's amazing.
When they opened up those gates.
Yeah, I don't want to, because I saw what happened in Tennessee over the weekend. I've seen it at Ole Miss and so many other SEC places, Arkansas. But the experience in Starkville, I really do think, is unique. And I think it's just a quintessential small town that has just wrapped its arms around a sport that they've always been really good at, and the history is well known.
Yeah, well, the one thing from like the beginning, even with the regionals and things, was they were in so many areas all over the United States, and you felt like you were taking a little travel vacation, you know, to each one of those places, and then, you know, to see the background, to see just the fans and everything. It's really been exciting. So anyway, but listen, Paul, you're doing a great job, and we're just so thankful to have you there.
Catherine, thank you for saying that.
No matter who calls in and says something,
it means a great deal. You take care of yourself.
Okay, Paul, thank you.
And be well. Thank you very much. Appreciate that call. Mitch is up next in South Carolina.
Hey, Uncle Paul, how are you?
Mitch, I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing well. First off, I want to say something about your call with Catherine. It reminds me of what I guess I wish I could have had as a child. You know, the upbringing with a mother and father and all that. But it also emphasizes, and I know a lot of people get tired of hearing me say this, but it emphasizes the family feel I get from your show. So I haven't completely lost out on a family. But I do want to make a comment. I can't remember his name, and his name's not really worth remembering. The guy that called, that you interviewed in the first hour.
That was Jerry Palm.
How insensitive, how tone deaf can a person be in 2021?
Well, Mitch, I think you heard my reaction to it, and I literally, I almost came out of my chair. I thought the answer was so pathetic, and I don't normally do a critique of the guest, but I was embarrassed for Jerry that he said what he did.
I mean, I know that it's a subject that has many angles that people don't, but coming from a victim's angle, I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor. But coming from that, to hear someone say just because someone's dead, it's not a big deal.
Well, you know, what he said was, I asked him about the Bo Schembechler thing, and he said, well, you know, Bo's not here to defend himself. And I'm thinking about, how many other people in history could you apply that to?
Well, I just thought somebody needs to pull him aside. If his job is to work with the public,
I believe every story should be heard, and there are two sides to every story, although saying somebody's not around to defend themselves when their son said what his son did about Bo Schembech, or basically saying, you know, suck it up. I mean, it's too bad that you've been abused, but keep your mouth shut.
Well, I mean, I hate to tell you this, but when you interview Joe Paterno's son, I have to turn it. I won't watch it because I just.
Well, no, I understand that, but let me say this about Joe Paterno's son. I mean, you're talking about Jay Paterno. Yeah, I know he's been.
I know, but he likes to.
He has been steadfast in his support of his father, but at least you can't blame Jay Paterno for anything other than supporting his father.
No, I agree, but I just can't hear it.
No, that's fair. I understand that very well. I mean, that's not hard for me to understand. And every time we have Jay on, we catch a lot of flack. And hey, thanks for the call, Mitch. We're up against a break. We have a guest coming up. He is Stuart Mandel, eager to hear what he has to say about where we all are in college football right now. That is right around the corner.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You're not worth a flip.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be. Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-hour energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5hourenergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
And we welcome all of you back here on a Tuesday afternoon. College football dynasties from Alabama, Notre Dame to USC prove parity sounds better in theory than practice. That comes from Stuart Mandel, of course, who runs the college football part of The Athletic. Stuart, thank you. Great to have you with us. So much to talk about. Let's talk about this article first before we get way too deep in the weeds on the CFP. And they're really curious and eager to hear about your theory here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Paul. This week on The Athletic, we're running a whole series about what we're calling college football's parity panic. And it's no secret, fans are tired of the Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Oklahoma reign over college football, and in particular Alabama. And I get it, and that's part of the big reason why we're looking at a 12-team playoff. But the point of my article was, I don't think it's realistic that you're ever going to see a version of college football where there isn't a small handful of programs that dominate, because that's been the case in the entire history of the sport. There have been a couple one-off seasons where you got a Georgia Tech national championship, or certainly everybody remembers the 2007 season and all those upsets. But going back to Walter Camp, to Newt Rockne, to Bud Wilkinson, and so on, there's always a small handful of schools that are the dynasties of that era. And I think it's frankly healthy for college football to have dynasties, because it gives the rest of the country a villain, if you will, to root against.
And Stuart, that brings us to the biggest story of the summer, at least so far, and that's what we're learning about the CFP. And as someone who has been at the front row of this conversation from the beginning, when it first started to trickle out, I'm curious what went through your mind, especially considering what a long journey this has been.
Paul, when that press release came out in late April and they just flat out told us all voluntarily that they were looking at larger playoff models, including 12, 16 teams, it went so against the way these guys have operated for 20 years. At first I thought maybe it was a prank. They were pranking us. And I'll be honest, I've spent you know, Lord knows how much time, how many column inches I've spent on playoff expansion over the years, and never had I realistically considered 12 teams. I just always assumed it would be 8, and if it was going to go bigger, then it would be 16. I never thought about 12. Now that we've had some time to digest it, I do think it's a good model. There's kind of something in it for everybody, whether it's you're Alabama and you're playing for a first-round bye, or you're, you know, an Iowa State or an Indiana or somebody who never sniffs the playoff now but might make it in a top 12 model. So I think there's a lot to like about it, but I can't emphasize enough what a drastic departure this whole approach is from how the BCS operated and how the first 7 years of the CFP operated.
And now, by now, Stuart, I know you've spoken to many important people and influential people, and you know, we're trying to get a better understanding. I've heard some of the players talk about this, but I'm still struggling to accurately gauge how they got from point A to point B. And I'm curious what you think was the tipping point.
I think the tipping point, well, I think it started with the 2018 season. That was when you first heard some grumbling afterward from Jim Delaney, from Bob Bowlesby. I think, UCF winning 25 straight games and not being able to get higher than 8th in the rankings was an eye-opener for people. And I think that's when the tide started to turn, and you didn't have as many of the original commissioners that designed the 4-team playoff defending the 4-team playoff. How we got from there to here, I truly believe, is about the SEC and Greg Sankey, who has the least to gain from an expanded playoff, given they're already dominating the 4-team event, but is able to see the damage it was doing to the rest of the sport to have entire parts of the country, mostly the West Coast, not included, not having an investment in the season. So I think he recognized that they needed to do something, but he wasn't going to agree to something that didn't benefit the SEC, obviously. And an 8-team playoff, he said this as much, an 8-team playoff where 6 of the berths are locked up for automatic bids is not necessarily an improvement over the setup the SEC has now. 12 teams, where half of them are at large berths, yeah, now you've got a chance to send possibly 3, 4. There was one year there would have been 5 SEC teams. It's a win for that league, but it's also a win for the other leagues who can feel like, you know, if we have, unless our champion is a kind of like a fluky 7-5 type team, the Power 5 champions will get in pretty much every year.
Talking to Stuart Mandel. Stuart, I asked Bill Hancock this question the other day, and I've spoken to other people, and I know they're pointing toward 2 years from now, but we both know there are many complications. It seems to me you hire a bunch of lawyers and they can work through these rather easily, but what is your level of confidence that we get to this soon as opposed to having to sit around and wait for this thing to finally unwind in 4 or 5 years?
Everybody, Bill and others, keep warning us, keep trying to temper expectations. We may just stay put through 2026. It's really complicated. There's so many contracts involved. But I believe once they've gone, so Greg Sankey does not get on a call with the national media and espouse the merits of a 12-team playoff, and then they're going to turn around in a few months and say 5 more years of the current system. That would be such a buzzkill for everybody now that they've put this out there. And especially if they think it's doing damage to the sport, which was the message I got from that call, then why would you subject yourself to another 5 years of it? There is a lot to unwind, but ESPN has a strong, strong motivation to for them to do it earlier so that they would have the exclusive rights to or exclusive opportunity to hold on to it. If it goes through the rest of the contract, then the CFP can put it up to market, and Fox can bid on it, and CBS and whoever else, and you know, no guarantee that ESPN keeps it. If they, you know, basically pay up and make it worth their while, then yeah, I think they're gonna find a way to start it earlier. I also think that's why you see the bowl games still tied to this, because they do have contracts with those bowl games through 2026, and I don't think it would be that easy to just say we're kicking you guys out 3 years early. I think that's why that model has bowl games hosting both the quarterfinals and the semifinals.
Stuart, talking to Stuart Mandel from The Athletic here, I know you've done a lot of work on this, and the numbers are staggering. in relation to what all this could be worth. I know we're estimating, but I don't think it's too difficult to gauge where this is going. Share with us what you've learned and how much money are we talking about here?
Billions, Paul, billions per year. I worked with a firm called Navigate, who is a consulting firm that works a lot of the conferences, and they modeled this. Right now, the TV deal is worth, on average, $608 million a year that gets split among the various conferences. They believe that a 12-team playoff would triple that amount, triple it, to $1.9 billion per year, which is, for, you know, at the conference level, your cut of the CFP revenue goes from being, if you're a Power 5 conference, something like $7 to $10 million per school, which is, in the real world, big money, but in college football, kind of modest, to $25, $30 million or so a year. And, you know, some conferences, that's about what they make in total revenue, or some schools, per year. So some people would say that's a stretch. I'm sure if I called up five other consultants, some of them would say, no, I think it's going to be much lower than that. But the reality is everybody keeps waiting for a bubble to pop with sports TV rights, and it hasn't happened. If anything, it's the opposite. As more and more people move to on-demand viewing and streaming and cutting their cable, live sporting events are one of the few things left that you can really sell advertisers on, and the CFP is the most watched sporting event of the year outside of the NFL. And so you're taking it and going from three games, a three-game event, to an 11-game event. That's where it becomes just a cash cow.
And I know these are questions for down the road, but with that much money being pumped into college football, there's a million questions I could ask you on what it means and how it affects the sport. But I'm curious, just without really knowing that we're going to get there soon, but a couple of years from now, with all that money coming in, what changes? What's the impact?
Well, given the current climate around compensating athletes, and you've got, you know, senators about to introduce bills and states and whatnot, I don't think they can implement this without some sort of mechanism for the athletes to receive money. Now, NIL is about literally next month about to come legal in a lot of these states. The NCAA is supposed to pass something. We're a long ways of knowing how exactly that's going to play out. But I could absolutely see, you know, in the next playoff system, it's the, the All-State Sugar Bowl, and the players from the two teams get some sort of appearance fee from Allstate. It's not going to be the schools paying the players, not going to be the TV networks paying the players, but they now will now have the ability to make money from their name, image, and likeness. And, you know, I do think there'll be ways to use that to maybe address some of the ethical concerns of having players play as many as 17 games in a season, an NFL regular season equivalent, without some sort of additional compensation.
An exciting time to be around college football, and I don't think we could have said that a couple of months ago. Stuart, thank you so much. Great to have you on.
All right, thanks, Paul.
You got it. One of the best around. Stuart Mandel from The Athletic. He's at the absolute vanguard of what is happening in the college game. We will take a break. We still have 30 minutes to get your reaction. Busy show. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You're not worth a flip.
Is your schedule too packed to see a doctor about your erectile dysfunction? Well, with Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. They're changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and entirely online. Just answer a series of questions and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you free. No insurance needed. So what are you waiting for? Join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Paul. That's hims.com/Paul for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/Paul.
Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies on product and subscription plan.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
We're back. Final few minutes of the show. Let's go to Thomas in Kentucky up next. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, Paul. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
A couple months later about the newspaper a little bit and about how local writers were, sports writers were having an impact on high school kids. But I want to talk a little bit about Joe Namath as your pans down your little bookshelf back there. I saw a book on there, Namath, and it reminded me of a book that I had that was written by Joe Namath. You know, Paul, when I was young and growing up, I liked the Packers and Bart Starr, and then as the AFL began to develop in 69 and 70, and of course the famous prediction year, then my other favorite quarterback was Joe Namath and the Jets. And I'll give you one guess on which of those two my father liked and didn't like.
The juxtaposition of Bart Starr and Joe Namath is pretty dramatic.
But what it reminded me of is we were watching your show and listening to your show today, my wife and I, is how much sports was changing back then, and then, you know, the things that we're seeing now with, you know, the players having an opportunity for their likeness and different things. And, you know, it just goes to show you that we all have to adapt and, you know, understand. You know, I'm old school, but I see how these things are changing. But on a lighter note, the book that Joe Namath wrote was called I Can't Wait Until Tomorrow Because I Get Better Looking Every Day.
Thomas, I'll never forget. I read that as a teenager. He did it with Dick Schaap. I think to this day it remains one of the greatest titles of all time.
No doubt about it, but it wasn't a big book, as you probably well remember, or whatever. But you know, he was such an influence, and I was joking about my father, but you know, to be the kind of outspoken athlete he was, and you know, he the Broadway Joe. I don't know if you knew this or remember this, but he opened up a franchise of Broadway Joes that was like an Arby's. You remember that?
I do. Joe Namath, it's hard for people to understand how famous Joe Namath was for a short period of time, late 60s in New York. I mean, he was on the level, and when I first got to know Joe a little bit later on, and I feel like I know him moderately well now, it was so shocking to me that I'm sitting here talking to this guy that both of us as kids we looked up to, and in full candor, I looked up to Joe Namath for all the wrong reasons. It had nothing to do with his football prowess.
Right. Yeah. I think we all did. You know, and that team. You know, I remembered all these names beforehand, but Don Maynard and the respect he had and the excitement that he generated. I mean, it was just incredible the way he could throw that football and how the, you know, the game has gone on, and you know, we're not even beginning to talk, as you have in the past, a little bit about his, you know, career injuries beside themselves of what he was able to do at Alabama. But my wife and I were talking about was listening to that, and you had some really good callers today, and you were talking about, you know, what your show has changed and offered in the 8 years since you've been on TV. But, Paul, one of the things you do, and I'm not blowing smoke at you, I know you don't like to have a lot of praises, but, you know, you educate people, too. This television outlet, to have the people you've on to talk about this NFL, you know, playoff expansion and the players and the likeness and the way the sports is changing, and, you know, to just get and hear these other people that you invite on and questions that you ask and your callers asking or whatever, it's a real educational process, and I think it helps not only old, you know, fogies like myself, but these college kids and high school kids that are living this now, you know, and I'm just thankful that we have this outlet. But I was glad that you remembered that book.
Because, oh, yeah.
Of course, Dick Shepard, the greatest sports writers of all time. It was a different era, but Joe Namath, like you said, it's hard to understand just how famous he was.
Thomas, thank you so much. What a pleasure. I've had the opportunity to talk to Dick Shep's son, Jeremy, who, of course, works at ESPN, about that experience. They did a book many years later with Bo Jackson, which was quite interesting. Anyway, Squirrel is up next. I don't want to take any of his time. Squirrel, good afternoon.
Well, man, I appreciate you just taking my call. And, you know, I've said for years your show was educational. You know, you learn new words here, new phrases. You learn about history, and, you know, you learn about all kinds of things on this show. So, you know, I encourage people to listen in just for that aspect alone. But the lady was correct. You do seem a lot more relaxed lately. I don't know what the...
Well,
I think it
has everything to do with having survived last year, like you and everyone else. One day I will write a book about my own personal experiences. But I mean, there's some reasons for that, and I'll get into them later. But right now, some of them are still unfinished, but
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but I'm glad the medicine is working, Squirrel.
Well, that's good. You know, you're talking, you know, about everybody's excited about this 12-team playoff, and you know, when I heard Hancock on your show last week, I didn't get any indication that was going to happen anytime soon. I mean, he brought up these contracts that are in place, and people don't realize. I mean, you just don't blink your eye and those contracts go away.
Squirrel, you're right. I talked to somebody yesterday who said, don't start saying this is done. And
no, it's not. I mean,
the cynic in me has a hard time believing that you can't, you know, get a bunch of, you know, $1,000 an hour lawyers and they can't figure this thing out. They can, but it's just a matter of how many toes they have to step on to get there.
Well, these people with these contracts are going to expect their money. And like I said, it's a lot more complicated than people think. But, you know, I was listening to your call with Jeff and with I-Man. And you know what I think the problem is, Paul? You just never – y'all never got closure. You know what I'm saying? Things ended so abruptly. y'all never had any closure.
Well
– And would it surprise you to know he's back on Twitter?
No, it wouldn't. I'm glad that he was able to sneak on there.
Would it surprise you to know that we follow each other?
No, I mean, he's an entertaining follow.
He's been civil. He's been very civil, and I've been very civil, and we've kind of buried that.
Well, let me say this. Tomorrow, as you well know, the two leaders of the free world, or not the free world, but the two leader of the free world and the leader of the not so free world are meeting in Geneva. So why don't we talk? Maybe the two of us, with your help, can meet maybe in what, Yazoo City, Mississippi, or something.
I was thinking the Bright Star.
Well, the Bright Star. I was supposed to be at the Bright Star a week ago, and I had to leave early and go to the airport. But there is a room. I don't know. There is a, and I've had the fortune of being in this room. There's a room in the back of the Bright Star called
the Bear Bryant room,
and I think that would be the perfect place for you, me, and the artist formerly known as Jim from Tuscaloosa to meet.
Let's have a peace summit at the Bright Star. You make it
And
happen.
I'm willing to bet you right now, Squirrel, whatever amount of money that we could come together with, that the two of us will show up and he won't.
I'm going to make sure he's there personally.
Man. Okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good luck.
Aloha.
Thanks for the call. We're heading to a break. We have a lot. Well, not a lot. That's just a TV phrase. We have a few minutes remaining here on our program. We are officially out of time for this program. We appreciate all of you for being a part of it. Some really interesting guests today. We'll see you right here tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast. The Paul Feinbaum Show airs weekdays on the SEC Network beginning at 3 Eastern.